Good morning. I'm Rick Mullaney, the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and welcome to Policy Matters, WJCT's quarterly radio program that takes a close look at public policy issues that matter to you and to the future of our city, state, and nation. First Coast Connect and Melissa Ross will be back tomorrow at 9 a.m. Thank you for being with us. On our program today, we are very pleased to have one of Florida's truly great public servants, former Florida governor, a two-term Florida governor, three-term U.S. senator, a candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States and seeking the 2004 nomination, former governor and senator Bob Graham. And we're also very pleased to have Chris Hant, former chief of staff to Alvin Brown, Princeton graduate, Fletcher graduate, University of Florida College of Law graduate, and a lawyer here in Jacksonville. Senator Graham and Chris, welcome to today's program.
Thank you for having us, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
We are very pleased to have you here with us today. If you'd like to join today's conversation with the senator and with Chris, please give us a call at 549-2937, 549-2937. Senator, we have a lot to talk about today. And I certainly want to talk about the Graham Center that you've established at the University of Florida. I'd like to talk about the book that you and Chris are writing, and certainly talk about Amendment 1 and your efforts on conservation. But before we do, given your service as governor of the state of Florida and as U.S. Senator, is there a message or a comment for the people of Jacksonville and our listeners today regarding the future of the state and your thoughts about the future here in Florida?
Rick, first, thank you very much for the chance to be with you today and last night at the wonderful event with your advisory council, great discussions. I think that the reason that there is the current distrust and almost disassociation from government goes back to the fact that we stopped teaching about citizenship and civics almost 40 years ago in this country. And therefore, we've had a couple of generations who have grown up without any formal introduction to what it means to be a citizen in a democracy. Words like tolerance and compromise are out of a lot of people's dictionary. And we're paying the cost for that now. And I believe that one of the reasons that the presidential campaigns have become as harsh as they have has its roots in the fact that politicians understand that their audience doesn't know a great deal about what they can do, and so therefore they can make promises that sound as if they think they're going to be the next czar of Russia rather than president of the United States of America. And so what we're working towards at the Graham Center at the University of Florida and what you're doing at Jacksonville University have a common objective, which is to get more people involved in their democratic citizen privilege and to be able to do it more effectively. I describe citizenship as being more skill than theory. That is, people need to know how to use their rights in a way that will accomplish their objective. The fact is, you can fight City Hall and you can win if you know what you are doing, if you're equipped with the skills to be effective in doing so. So that's what's kind of on my mind, how to get this and past generations of Americans reconnected with their government by getting them directly involved in being a force to make government what they would like it to be.
Chris, you've had some involvement both at City Hall and working for the senator from 1996 to 2000. What about this whole topic? I think it's an important topic. And he mentioned the presidential debates, and I think last Saturday night's debate was maybe an example of the opposite of this notion of maybe civility, of values, of what my mother might call good manners, but also civic engagement to make government work. How about comments? Because I know that's a part of your book, and it's a big discussion in the country today.
Well, it is, Rick, and you see the roots of maybe some of what we're talking about. Back in sort of at the end of 2015, the Pew Charitable Trust did a very interesting survey of 6,000 adults, which had some jarring results. 74% of those surveyed said they didn't think that elected officials cared about what people like you or me think. Half believe there was little that everyday citizens could do to influence the course of events at the governmental level. Those are sort of very concerning numbers, which I think actually speak to the need, as we try to talk about in our book, America, the Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You, to approach the sort of teaching and the practice of citizenship in a different way. As Senator Graham has talked about, you know, to the extent there was any civics education during that 40-year period, much of it was teaching civics as a spectator sport. Basically, you know, the three branches of government, the names of members of Congress, what the preamble to the Constitution says. And there's no doubt that's important foundational knowledge. We want people to know that. But it really isn't the entire picture. In order to really be successful in engaging the public, people have to know they need to learn by doing and actively engage, use their citizenship muscles and engage their citizenship skills. There is a proven skill set, which we talk about in the book, that if properly exercised, people can influence government and can move government in the direction they want. And I think it's important that we reorient citizenship education in this country so that we teach people those skills.
You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 549-2937, 549-2937. We are very pleased to have with us Senator Bob Graham and Chris Hand, the former Chief of Staff to Mayor Alvin Brown, on today's program. Senator, this your comments earlier about making government work, about getting citizens involved. Was this at the root or the driving force behind your founding of the Graham Center at the University of Florida? And can you describe that center for us?
It was. My feeling is that universities have a particular responsibility in resurrecting citizens, since that they are empowered as it relates to government. They are the place that, for instance, prepares the next generation of teachers who will hopefully teach more and a different type of civics, a civics that's oriented towards direct involvement and the skills necessary to be effective in that direct involvement. We also are interested in policy and how to help local communities and the state and the nation understand and be more effective in the things that they do. Because when government does things right, it not only benefits the citizens who are directly affected, but it elevates the general feeling that government is a competent organization and that we can look to it to solve some of the problems that we cannot solve alone. So, yes, that's the core purpose of the Graham Center, as it is of your center at Jacksonville University. It may take 20 years to look back and see, have we made a real difference? But I think we can, we will, and that our state, communities, and the nation will be better because of it.
Well, Senator, we have lots of people on the line now who'd like to ask you a question or two, and thank you. We're gonna turn to one of our callers. Jay, I understand you're calling from Tampa. Do you have a question for the senator or for Chris?
Well, I have more of a comment, actually. I think part of the problem that we have with our government is that it's not necessarily easy to get engaged. If you try to find out about a public hearing, sometimes it's buried in a newspaper in small font. You know, it's not put out there. You know, if it's a concert or something, then, you know, we get lots of advertising and marketing. And, you know, so there's actually a really great TED Talk about this very thing, that it's not voter apathy that stops people from getting engaged. It's the fact that the information isn't presented in a way that's easy to access and is easy to understand and make it easy for people to get engaged. I worked in politics and have volunteered for many campaigns and whatnot, and I think that there's a lot to be said for how do we make this process easy for people to get a hold of, and then I think we can really gauge whether people are interested in the political process. But the way it is now, it's very cumbersome. It, you know, the meetings are sometimes at 9 o'clock in the morning when people have to go to work. So there's a lot of barriers for people that want to get engaged with our political process. Well,
Jay, thank you very much for your comment. And Chris, how about, he makes very articulate, and he makes the case that maybe it's not just lack of knowledge, it's it's difficult. How about commenting on that?
Well, I think, Jay, thank you for your call, and you raise an excellent point. And having worked in local government for much of the last several years, I think you raise some valid points, and there is an obligation on the part of governments to be transparent and accessible and to help make sure that citizens are aware of their opportunities to engage. In the new and improved version of our book that we are currently writing that will be published in July or August of this year, America, the Owner's Manual, one of our so-called tips from the pros, our expert contributions, is from the former mayor of Indianapolis, Stephen Goldsmith, who he talks about the compact that must exist between governments and citizens. And the obligation he puts on governments is to provide reliable data and make sure that their processes and the information that citizens need is readily accessible. The obligation of citizens is to take that information, use it to kind of help suggest solutions to decision makers, and it's that sort of working together that ultimately produces the best results. So, Jay, you raise a great point. There's a responsibility on both sides. When government does that, citizens have an obligation to take that information and use it to engage as much as they possibly can.
We have another caller on the phone. Arthur, welcome to today's program. Do you have a question for the senator or for Chris?
Yes, I do. I just wanted to I'm in Atlantic Beach, and I wanted to know, I heard an admiral say that I've never seen a president more disrespected than the president that we have today. And if you could comment on that. And then also, I have three daughters. They're 13, 12, and 10. What can I do to get them interested in just getting to know what, you know, what to do to get involved in civics?
Arthur, thank you very much for your question. Senator, that last part of that question is right up the alley of what you've been working on so hard. So I want to thank Arthur for his question and turn that one over to you, Senator.
Let me start with the first comment. I think that we've gotten into a situation in politics where if you disagree with someone, and that's perfectly all right. In fact, progress comes from people presenting their best ideas and having them compete with each other. But it goes beyond just disagreement. It goes to demonization, that you have to make your opponent or the person who's offering an alternative path to the future a bad person. And what you've said about the president may be the most visible example of that demonization. I hope that we're going through a bad patch and that this hasn't become embedded in our political culture.
You know, Senator, I could, on that, I think this is a really important topic. I myself feel like what we've seen as a country, when you take a look at, in Congress in particular, this very topic, if Republicans and Democrats, and let's talk about Congress for a second, I know he's talking about the president, if they would assume that each side loves the country, and if they would assume good intentions, and then have a policy debate about how best to get there, wouldn't it change the whole tenor of what we're doing?
Absolutely. I think there are several things that are keys to moving beyond demonization. One is to get to know each other. One of the problems in Washington is that while in the past Congress only met for 6 months of the year, everybody worked 5 days a week, you stayed there over the weekend, you got to know your colleagues and their spouses and their children, so that when you went on the floor on Monday, you were less likely to scream at an opponent who you'd had barbecue and beer with the day before. That has largely vanished, particularly because of the amount of money that it takes to stay in Congress, and members, after they serve now what typically is a 3-day work week, are hustling around their local community or around the nation preparing for the next campaign. That's an issue that Congress can deal with and I hope will deal with. Second, as to the advice to the gentleman's daughters, as the father of four daughters myself, I can relate to that. My advice would be to ask your daughters, is there something going on in your neighborhood, in your school, that you think could be done better, that you'd like to see changed? I taught a semester of high school civics while I was still in the state legislature, and that was the first question we asked of our students, and had them select a topic upon which one-third of their final grade was going to be based on how successful they were in solving the problem. And they came up with things like that the water served by their local private water system wasn't very good. It was not a Flint, Michigan situation, but it was not an acceptable situation. And those 17-year-olds took that on. They learned how you tested water so that they were talking science, not just emotion. They learned who was responsible for assuring that there was a quality water in their neighborhood. And then they lobbied that group that after having collected samples so that they had real evidence of some of the problems with the water. And in less than 6 months, the water was noticeably better. That's the kind of way I think people learn about government, is to get involved, make a difference. And if you can be successful as a 17-year-old, what can you do when you're 27 or 37 or 47? It gives you a sense of psychological empowerment that you have done it once, I can do it again.
Well, Senator, can I give you a quick example, Chris, also from our book, America, the Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You? In the original version we published in 2010, our leading case study, what we do is we teach 10 skills. Each one is accompanied by a case study of citizen or citizens who have used that skill to influence government. The case study that led that version of the book was called Campaign Georgetown. It was about several students from Georgetown University in Washington who returned home from summer break to learn that the university and a local government body had sort of worked together to change the rules regarding parking near campus and living near campus. Well, they didn't like these rules, and they got organized and through an election took over their local advisory neighborhood commission. So it's possible to do this at a very young age. And we encourage people to get involved as early as possible.
Thank you, Chris. I'm Rick Mullaney with Jacksonville University's Public Policy Institute. You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. We have a number of phone calls. Ray, welcome to the program. Do you have a question for the senator or for Chris Hand?
Yeah, I've been listening, and you know, I applaud all of your efforts to give people education about our government and how it works and how they can get involved. But when you have 75% of the voters in the state agree that we should amend the Constitution to protect our environment, and then the legislature just completely ignores it to the point that the conservation groups are having to take them to court and sue them to try to make them do their job, it's a bit discouraging, don't you think?
Well, yeah, and Ray, I want to thank you for this. This gentleman has touched on something right in the wheelhouse, Senator, and that is Amendment 1, which you were the leader of. And how about commenting on this land and water preservation amendment and what it means, and a great comment by the question.
That's an excellent question and an excellent example of citizen involvement. We have an organization called the Florida Environmental Coalition, and its purpose is to try to get citizens involved. As an example, last year, including at Jacksonville University, we did training sessions where we prepared citizens with the skills to be able to effectively lobby their legislators, primarily on behalf of Amendment 1 and other conservation matters. I would like to extend an invitation for you to attend what I hope will be our next training session. And what we do is we assign a legislator to each one of these people, and the citizen activist becomes responsible for establishing a relationship with the legislator so that he or she has confidence in the citizen, and then providing the legislator with good information. For instance, our state ended the 20th century with about 18 million plus people. It's projected that by the end of the 21st century, the one that we're in today, at a minimum, we will have close to 40 million people in Florida and could have substantially more than that. That's the Florida that Amendment 1 is looking at. How do we prepare in terms of protecting the most important lands that in turn protect our water supply, such as the banks of the St. John's River? How do we assure that there's an adequate recreational opportunity for Floridians? We have a wonderful state park system for 18 million people. It would be overrun at 40 million if so we're going to need to expand. Those are the kind of issues that a citizen can take to their legislator and sign up, become a citizen activist.
Rick, Chris, could I Chris, add something to that? Sure. And I just wanted to make, Ray, thank you for an excellent call and obviously an issue that both Senator Graham and I feel very strongly about. But I wanted to make a suggestion. I'm not sure what part of the region you live in, Ray, but in 2016, between Duval, Nassau, and Clay counties, we have 5 open seats in the Florida House of Representatives. We'll be electing 5 new members. That's a pretty significant change in the delegation. What I would encourage you and others who feel strongly about Amendment 1 to do is, while making sure you abide by all election laws, use this as an opportunity for education. Those are 5 members who have not been in the legislature, would probably welcome the opportunity to learn more about your views on Amendment 1, maybe have not seen some of the areas of our region that would be protected if Amendment 1 dollars were used here. So whether it's personally or through whatever organization you're involved with, engage those members, teach them now before they've joined the legislature so that by the time they get to Tallahassee, they're in the right frame of mind to vote on these Amendment 1 issues once they arrive there.
Well, Chris, we're going to take a break. We have a number of callers. I hope you'll stay with us. We're with Senator Bob Graham. We were with former Chief of Staff Alvin Brown, Chris Hahn. You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. We're going to take a brief break. Please stay with us.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
When you're a personality, you gotta have a brand identity.
It's not from me. It's from hearing from the audience that I have been told that they see me as their awkward older sister.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, comedian, author, and actress Grace Helbig. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Meet Kareem Salim El Amin of Baltimore.
Went to prison when I was 18 in 1971. I served 42 years, 3 months, and 3 days, 2013.
And William Gardner.
I served 46 years and 5 months. Got locked up when I was 16.
Why did they and dozens of other Maryland lifers get out of prison, and how are they handling their freedom? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater, What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Sponsored in part by Folio Media House.
Welcome back to Policy Matters, WJCT's quarterly radio program that takes a look at policy matters that matter to you and the future of our city, our state, and our nation. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. And on today's program, we're very, very honored to have with us Senator Bob Graham and also Chris Hahn, the former Chief of Staff to Mayor Alvin Brown. We have lots of callers who've been very patient. And so I do want to talk some more about Amendment 1, but I do also want to go to some of our callers. So, Senator, I think we're going to go to Ricky, who has been very patient hanging in through the break. Ricky, welcome to the program.
Very, very honored to have with us Senator Bob Graham.
Yes, hello. Hello?
Yes, Ricky, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I got a question for the senator and the other panelists.
Okay.
Yeah, how would you handle a situation where you have, for example, the Georgia-Pacific refusing to accept a study that was made on St. John's indicating that there is valid grounds for limiting what they put into St. John's because it is causing quite a bit of pollution, negative pollution, and destroying a lot of the natural species that live in the in the St. John's River. In other words, here's a large company that refuses to accept the study, and now they are forcing policymakers to have a new study which favors them. That's my question. Thank you.
Ricky, thank you very much for your question. Now, Chris, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the St. John's and Georgia Pacific at all. And this does relate to the overall Amendment 1 question. We're talking about conservation, water quality.
Sure. Well, Ricky, this is first of all, you raise an issue that's of great interest here in Jacksonville, obviously the health of the St. John's River and the situation in particular that you raise is one that's been a matter of great discussion in recent years. Ricky, one thing I would encourage you to do is look for sort of like-minded people to sort of form coalitions with to address that issue. We have some very strong environmental organizations here in Northeast Florida, not the least of which is the St. John's Riverkeeper. Senator Graham and I, as he said earlier, had a training session back in 2015 that was hosted by the Riverkeeper and Jacksonville University, where some of these types of issues were discussed. So one of the chapters of our book, America the Owner's Manual, is called All for One and One for All. It's about building coalitions. I'd encourage you to do that. Look for organizations like the Riverkeeper and others who are concerned about the same issues you were, and look for strength in numbers.
You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. We are very thrilled and excited to have with us Senator Bob Graham and Chris Hahn. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have a comment or a question, please give us a call at 549-2937, 549-2937. Senator, I wanted to back up a little bit to Amendment 1. We may have assumed a little more knowledge for some of our listeners to maybe explain back in 2014, and the caller had mentioned the 75% approval of the people of the state of Florida in passing this amendment that you showed such dramatic leadership on because of its importance to the future of the state. And I think the demographic numbers you gave highlight how important it is, growing from 18 million to nearly 40 million by the end of the century. How about explaining to our listeners what Amendment 1 is and why it's important to the future of the state?
For almost 50 years, Florida has had an aggressive program of identifying the lands of Florida that were most important to the protection of our water supply primarily, but also to providing recreational opportunities for our people and to preserve some of the natural Florida that those of us who've had the privilege of living here for a lifetime have come to know and enjoy. That program has generally provided between $200 and $300 million a year for environmental land acquisition, and some of the most important areas in Northeast Florida were the result of an acquisition over that 50-year time span. The program started to slow down and then come to a halt during the Great Recession. You can say, well, that was understandable because we had so many other urgent day-to-day requirements such as education, health care, that we didn't have the extra money to spend on the long-term investment in protecting environmental lands. Well, now the Great Recession, thank goodness, is largely behind us. Our state budget is about to where it was in 2007 or 8, and we should begin to restore that. The people of Florida sent a powerful message that they expected the legislature to restore our environmental lands acquisition program by voting for a measure into the state constitution, which said that roughly one-third of the real estate transfer tax, that is a small tax that is paid every time real estate is transferred in Florida, which is somewhat an indicator of the extent of growth in Florida. So the two subjects, environmental land and growth, are appropriately connected. That a third of that money should be constitutionally devoted to land acquisition. Unfortunately, the legislature has largely ignored that. In fact, ironically, they're even spending less in this period than they did during the years of the Great Recession, in spite of Amendment 1. I think it's going to take citizens who are concerned about this, who understand the values that we have received from previous acquisitions and the importance of new acquisitions for this new second Florida that is just over the horizon, to become politically active, contacting legislators, urging them to do what 75% of Floridians have asked, directed them to do, which was to protect Florida for the second and third Floridas that are on the way.
And so we can't take, if I might, that we can't take this for granted in the sense that there are incredible environmental treasures just here in our area that were acquired through land preservation. The Guanatolomata Reserve, which actually was acquired when Senator Graham was governor in a partnership with the state of Florida and the Gate Corporation in the 1980s, Julington-Durbin Creek Preserve in southern Duval County. So there are treasures that have been bought by land preservation programs in the past, and we don't want to take those for granted.
Thank you both. We have a very, very patient man who has been waiting a long time for his phone call. So, Tom, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
And Tom, thank you for hanging in there. I know that you've had to wait a while. I want to thank you for your patience. Do you have a question for the senator or for Chris?
Just a comment. My observation at this point is I think there are two big things that we are really affecting the American politics to a negative extent. And the first of these is there are candidates who have all realized that it is far easier to be negative and to be against things than it is to be for things, because if you're for something, then someone might expect you to show results. And the other thing, and this gets to the point the gentleman was making about the river, is the influence of the political action committees, which Georgia Pacific is owned by one of the biggest donors to political action committees, the Koch brothers.
Well, Tom, thank you for your comments. Senator, do you have any comments on his comment, actually, talking about the candidate's approach becoming negative rather than positive, and also about the influence of money?
Political candidates, like advertisers for any product, try to understand their customers and what their customers want. And the fact that we have so many negative ads is that somebody has figured out, or at least come to the conclusion, that's what the public wants and will respond to. Again, I think it's our opportunity as citizens to change that and to tell candidates that, look, we're tired of having you yell and scream at your opposition and talk about all the things that you are against. I'm going to vote for the candidate who will tell me what they are for and how will my community be a better place because we elected you than if we elected your opponent. It's that power of the voter to tell the politician that we don't like what you're selling now. You better get a different product on the shelf or you're not going to get us to buy you.
You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a comment or question, please give us a call at 549-2937, 549-2937. We are very honored and privileged today to have Senator Bob Graham and Chris Hand, the former Chief of Staff for Mayor Alvin Brown. I have a question for both of you relating to the last question and our callers, if they'd hang in there with us. And that is his second part of his question related to money and political action committees. And, you know, Senator, it seems to me, and I'll pose this for both of you, that one of the things we've seen in the presidential race on both the Republican side and the Democratic side, and I think some of the support for Bernie Sanders and some for Donald Trump, is this sense of being beyond the reach of money, this notion that big money is having such a huge effect on policy, mm-hmm. that big money is having such a big effect on candidates, the idea that Bernie Sanders is not taking that money and is making a very big campaign against it and for campaign finance reform, as well as an anti-money position. And Donald Trump taking a little bit of a different pathway, saying, listen, I don't need their money. I'm going to do it myself. Senator and Chris, any comments on this notion of the role of money in influencing policy and government involvement?
Americans are smart, and they understand that when a individual or a corporation makes a massive political contribution, it's not just out of a sense of civic duty and philanthropy, that there often is a quid pro quo in the process. And I'm fortunately, you're seeing it, for instance, in Tallahassee. Some legislation has passed over the last couple of years, or failed to pass, which has been very detrimental to our water supply. And it became the law of Florida, I think, largely because of the influence of big interests that had been major contributors to members of the legislature. That's a harsh statement to make, but unfortunately, from my experience, I think it is a true statement. Now, fundamentally, we need to get back to some rational limits on running for public office. When I ran for governor, and it was back in the 70s and 80s, I would spend for a campaign maybe $5 or $6 million. Today, that's just chump change. Gubernatorial candidates are spending $100 million for their elections. That is insane. We need to have some reasonable standards that protect the public interest against excessive interest by big donors. That's going to require some changes at the United States Supreme Court level, because it has basically ruled that you cannot in any way limit money in politics. I hope that in the future the court will revisit that decision and allow us to do what we did for most of the 20th century, which was to have reasonable restraints on the amount of money in politics.
Chris, any comment?
Well, Rick, a couple of things. One, a concern. One, a little more optimistic. There's no question that money plays a big role in politics. I think one of the concerning areas is the increasingly staggeringly high sums of money that have to be raised to either run for public office or to stay there. I think have probably dissuaded a number of people, a number of good people who understand that policy matters and want to come to the right outcomes, have maybe been dissuaded from running from office. So that's a concern as a barrier to entry. But a slightly more optimistic piece. Even in the face of kind of large money, citizens can be successful. The case study that's going to lead the new version of our book, America, the Owner's Manual, which will come out in July or August of this year, is about a very interesting coalition in the state of Georgia between members of the Georgia Tea Party, the Georgia Sierra Club, and solar power advocates who work together to overcome the opposition from a large utility in the state of Georgia to increase the amount of solar power being utilized in that state. So I would sort of close on a note of optimism. Even in the face of large money invested in politics, citizens can prevail if they follow and utilize the citizenship skills that they have.
Well, Chris, thank you for that optimistic note. And Bill, I want to thank you also for being very patient. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Well, thanks very much. Just a note, first of all, need to remind our listeners that when we elect and pay our representatives, we pay them to vote and elect them to vote, but not necessarily think. I would like, and I think Chris Hand's experience with the city council on the pension fund when he's serving our city demonstrates that. But I often wondered, did you make any studies about the effectiveness of a very active media, news media in each community, and helping a community be more activist in influencing its legislatures, both print as well as electronic?
Thank you, Bill.
The media plays a critical role because generally the public becomes aware of a problem. The St. John's River is being polluted by an industrial discharge, or the textbooks in your school are 10 years out of date, and so your children are not getting the most up-to-date information in their curriculum. Those are the kinds of things that generally it is the media that will write a story about or discuss it on a program such as this, and the public suddenly becomes aware that there's a problem, And that awareness is the first step in effective citizen engagement. The state of the media, as we used to know it, has been troubled. Many major newspapers are either out of business or have substantially cut back on their coverage, particularly their coverage of local news. The good news is, and this will be a major point of emphasis in the second edition of America, the Owner's Manual, is that there are new ways that are available to communicate all of the things that social media has made available as a means of direct communication with large numbers of people and organizing and motivating, which are available today and were almost unheard of even as recently as 10 years ago, have changed the landscape. And so you have the opportunity to be the equivalent of the publisher of the newspaper by using the social media assets that are right there on your computer.
You're listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University with our special guests, Senator Bob Graham and Chris Hand. Thank you for that question regarding the media. Chris, any comments on that, the role of the media? And if you'd like to join the conversation, let me just throw out for our, although we're getting short on time, please give us a call at 549-2937. 549-2937. Chris?
Well, and first of all, thank you, Bill, for raising that point. The media is critically important, and we actually address it in Chapter 8 of our book in a chapter called All Your News is Fit to Print, and Senator Graham's exactly right. One of the developments that caused us to write the new edition of the book is the explosion in social media over the last several years. Chapter 8 is led by the story of a Boston public health clinic that has primarily used social media to increase its visibility and awareness. So the point is that not only can you work through traditional media, and that's very important to do, but to some extent, you are the media and have the ability to directly message about your cause or advocacy effort.
Chris, thank you. And Bob, welcome to the program. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, thank you very much for this great public service. I'm new to your station, and I'm delighted to be able to interact with your panel. First of all, I should say I myself am running for president. I have a Facebook page, Hendren for President. But the thing I wanted to posit for the panel is the control of mosquitoes using cold as a weapon. This is an idea I've been working on for some time, and you would implement it by making or utilizing liquid nitrogen sprayers, just like the Orchid Man, to walk around and spray the bottle caps, the
is there a question?
Cans.
Yes.
have you considered the use of liquid nitrogen as a means of mosquito control to freeze the mosquito larvae when the eggs hatch and they rise to the surface? You lay a skin of ice or freeze bottle caps, and this would be something useful not only here in Florida, where we're definitely under threat, but certainly for the Olympics. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Bob, thank you very much for the phone call. Chris?
Well, Bob, I'm afraid I'm not familiar enough with the technology you're talking about to comment on that idea. But I am familiar enough with where you should address it. In addition to your own political activities, mosquito control is largely a function carried out by local governments, county and city governments around the state. So, again, I'm not sure exactly where you live, but what I'd encourage you to do is engage at the county or city level with your local mosquito control division or agency to share that idea with them.
And I would also add that the second chapter in America, the Owner's Manual, is on the topic of research. You will be more effective in convincing the general public and agencies that have a specific responsibility to the extent that you are talking about proven science rather than rumor or speculation. So I would encourage you to determine what agency has the responsibility for mosquito control in the community in which you live, and then second, be able to go to that agency with the best information possible on alternatives to dealing with mosquito control. I can tell you, the mosquitoes don't have a lot of allies. The people at that agency have spent their careers trying to control mosquitoes. If you can help them do it better, I think you'll have a very receptive audience.
Thank you, Senator. Ben, welcome to the program. Do you have a question for the senator or for Chris Hand?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Senator Graham, I'd like to hear your comments on two barriers to civic participation, particularly that our legislature doesn't actually represent the population in that there are more registered Democrats in Florida, but the legislature is about three-quarters Republican, and we have the legislature actually flouting the Fair District Amendment and trying to, you know, partisan gerrymander. And then the other barrier, I believe, is the felon disenfranchisement. We have 10% of our voting population that isn't able to actually participate in civic society by voting, and I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Ben, thank you very much. Senator?
First, on the second question of felony disenfranchisement, the policy in Florida for many years, including the 8 years that I was governor, was that if when a felon had served their full sentence and any post-sentence, for instance, parole, and had a clean record, that they were almost automatically restored of their civil rights. Beginning about 15 years ago, that policy changed, and now it is almost a mini trial to get your rights restored, which is expensive and cumbersome, and has had the effect that very few felons, no matter how pure their post-conviction period is, have not been able to have their civil rights, which are not only the right to vote, but there are many jobs in Florida that are prohibited to people who don't have their full civil rights. So it's an economic as well as a political issue, and I hope that the legislature and the governor, who has primary control over the grant of clemency, of which this is a form, will go back to the tradition of Florida.
And what about the redistricting piece?
Yeah, the redistricting piece, it's discouraging that it took intervention by the Florida courts to implement the constitutional amendment that was passed by a very strong vote requiring fair, impartial, nonpartisan districts for both the state legislature and our 27 members of Congress. I hope that this experience that the legislature has gone through of having its hands slapped pretty hard and spending several million dollars of your tax dollars resisting the constitutional amendment, that the court's firm intervention will send a message in the future, let's do what the people said, let's do it right.
I think we have time for one last caller. Esh, thank you. Welcome to the program. Do you have a question or comment for the senator, Chris Hand?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for the senator. I wanted to ask him about the recent fracking bill that passed through the House. I mean, we know about the ill effects of fracking through what's going on in Oklahoma with the fragile ecosystem in Florida. Like, shouldn't be investing in renewable resources like solar instead of, you know, fracking? And I take my question off the air.
Well, this is an issue that the Florida Conservation Coalition that I mentioned earlier has become very active in. The legislation did pass the Florida House and is now before the Senate, where apparently it's going to get greater scrutiny at a hearing that will come up later this week. I think that Florida needs to be very careful in this. I appreciate the contribution that fracking has made to America's energy independence, but it is still a high-risk situation, and particularly, as you say, given the geology of Florida, our largely limestone base, it has some potential effects of polluting our primary source of fresh water. So it needs to be approached very carefully. And I'm concerned that, for instance, the legislation that passed the House will not require the industries to say in advance what chemicals they're going to be putting into the ground so that there can be an evaluation of whether they are appropriate. Also, the legislation only regulates a few of the forms of fracking, and in fact, the form of fracking that's most likely to be utilized in Florida is not covered by the legislation, so they would go completely ungoverned.
Senator, I want to thank you for the – that's today's final word. We've covered a lot of ground today. You've covered a lot of ground, and on behalf of people of Jacksonville, North Florida, I want to thank you, Senator, for being on today's program. Chris, thank you very much for being on today's program. You've been listening to Policy Matters here on WJCT. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Sean Birch is the producer of the program. Tune in again tomorrow when Melissa Ross will be back on First Coast Connect. We enjoyed having you with us. Be with us again next time. We'll be right back.